Thank you. Oh, I'd like to say that Zion Press tonight.
Name of Dhwani. What does Dhwani mean? Dhwani means the sound of prema. That's what those prayers are called. Because it calls to mind so many holy persons and holy places. There. Zion Vishnu Patraman Subhadhati Sarasakaya Sakati and Sunani. His divine grace A.C. Bhakti Vidhanti Sama Shri Prabhupada Ki. Ananta Koti Vasavinda Ki. His confounded Acharya Sakati Prabhupada Ki. Prem Sri Gaur Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Adoita Gadadha Sri Vasari Gaur Vasta Vinda Ki. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Prabhu Gopinath Shai Mukunda Radha Kundi Giri Gaur Vadana Ki. Sri Vrindavan Dham, Sri Navadipadam, Gangamayi Ki Jai,
Vimulamayi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulasi Devi Ki Jai, Samaveda Devi Ki Jai.
All glories to your Samaveda. All glories to your Samaveda. All glories to your Sambhala devotees, all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga, Nitai Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bo. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Samane Tanamane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharane Navasesha Sanyavadi Prashkati Deza Tarane Om Aginata Minanga Sya Jala Jala Salakaya Chaksas Maritam Jaina Tashma Sri Guru Venama Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Sayam Tadamayam Vadati Savjantikam Since we're going to present the third and final part of the that what was the name of the presentation again? See who remembers that before the next question. The next question is what do you remember from the presentation? But at least we'll see if anyone remembers the title. Raise your hand if you remember the title. Wow, that's almost everyone. I also remember it. So in the first two presentations, we presented the question of the four Kumaras about how to separate the mind from the sense objects. In other words, the sense objects are there and the mind is within me, but yet my mind is always in the sense objects, and the sense objects, things, are always in my mind. We can't even imagine a mind that doesn't have any sense objects in it, any forms, any fragrances, any touch, or the other objects of the senses, sounds. We have, fragrances in our mind too. Did that ever happen to you? I remember it used to happen to me a few years ago. But sometimes when people cook chapatis. When the devotees are cooking chapatis, there's a particular fragrance that comes when the dough is of a particular kind, and that it reminds me of the first chapatis I've ever had when I first began chanting, and it calls up a whole scene in my mind of those early days, so many years ago. So there's a particular set of fragrances in my mind according to the Vedic system. The senses, that means the eyes, ears, and skin, and the whole, the nose, and the, what's the other one? Taste. Taste, yes, the tongue. They exist primarily in the mind. And sometimes, they exist primarily in the mind. So when one has a particular tendency to like a certain form or a certain sound, it starts in the mind. And the ability to perceive it starts in the mind. Interesting, this is, I'm really going on a tangent here. But sometimes if they want to teach, like young men, of course, ladies too, if they want to do it, how to play basketball really well, all you have to do is you show them the videos of all the great basketball games, and immediately, just by that mental cultivation of it, their basketball playing improves, even without going in physically doing anything. So much actually goes on in the mind. So much of our life, in case any of you haven't noticed it, goes on in our mind. And it, practically speaking, all our sense enjoyment goes on in the mind. Of course, the senses actually have something to do with it. But it's just, Prabhupada would sometimes call it mental speculation. The enjoyment that we try to experience, he would call it mental speculation. Because it's primarily existing in the mind. All the anticipation, when I get this, I'm going to enjoy. It's all in the mind. And the actual combination with the object, it doesn't produce the anticipated mental enjoyment. So it's very, very interesting. Reality is very subtle. And reality is something that's, as we've been hearing, is somewhat beyond our direct perception, because everything that we see, everything that we perceive, is influenced by our minds. So we see this bit of plastic. What's inside the plastic? Here, this little
cable.
What does that mean?
Copper.
Okay, there's copper inside that. So due to experience, no one can see the copper in there, but everyone knows that there's a copper or some kind of wire in there. Is it copper, actually?
Yes.
Huh?
And it's a high quality piece.
Okay, yeah, because why? Do you know why?
Because of
Conductivity. Copper's conductive. But the problem with copper, it releases a lot of the energy as heat. Anyway, we're really going tangential. Yeah. And then it doesn't transmit it. So anyway. But so much goes on in our minds. And sometimes our minds go in all kinds of different directions when we're trying to say something relatively simple about what we were previously speaking about. So exactly what reality is, separate from the mind, is not possible to tell, to say. And that is what the scientists are trying to do, to discern, to understand, with their intelligence, what reality, what is objective reality, what's actually out there, the stuff of existence, as they would say. But they can't. And the deeper one tries to pierce and objectify what actual reality is, the deeper one looks, the more confusing it becomes. They cannot do it. It becomes intricately complex. And every answer that one receives through this method opens up 10, 20, 30 more questions. So, does that mean that there is no reality, and when we look out here and no one sees the same thing? If we say, what color is this one's too easy? What color is this? No, everyone's afraid to say right now. It's red. Yes. Okay. Someone who's not afraid to be wrong. Congratulations. But it's some kind of a blue. This is specific color it's called, but is it? Oh yeah, the graphic artists know. This is what's, I always wondered what's, I thought that was reddish. No,
this is magenta.
Magenta, yes, okay. So it's not like the color doesn't exist, and that everyone's just perceiving different things, and we're agreeing, but actually, it's a, and they have this problem on, they have to figure out on computer monitors, that because you look on your monitor and you're seeing one type of a color, and someone else's monitor may be seeing a different kind of a color. So how do you know if it's, you come across this all the time, so you have to, what they call, calibrate the monitors so that they're seeing the same thing. So how do you, so what is the calibration of the mind that that so that we actually see reality as it is? So the Four Kumaras' conclusion was that if you try, you can't do it, and this is what the Hansa Avatar's conclusion was, you can't actually parse or cut to what reality is by your intelligence. But because the perceiver, and this is what that famous quantum double slit experiment shows, is one of the things it shows is that that the observer, the very act of observing, influences the object that is observed. So if just by looking at something, it's going to change what it does, at least on the quantum level. Then how are you going to say what it is without someone there to observe it, if you're the one who's observing it to say what it is? If you understand what I just said, it's not too late at night. But in any case, the conclusion of the Hansa Avatar is, don't try to figure it out with your own intelligence. Rather, understand that this is an energy of the Supreme Lord of Krishna, and this is an energy, and your mind is an energy of the Supreme Lord Krishna. And also, you yourself, the soul, the perceiver, is also an energy of the Supreme Lord. We're all, because that's what the absolute truth means. It's all inclusive. So instead of trying to break it apart and understand everything with intelligence, understand the subsuming, all-including principle that includes the concepts of everything, that includes everything else, and that is Krishna. So this is the perfection of yoga, actually. To be able to see Krishna in all things, and all things in Krishna, and to have one's consciousness focused always on the absolute truth, always focused on Krishna. This is the perfection of existence, of consciousness, called Krishna consciousness. And then, when one perceives that absolute truth, even if one is on the level where one sees the absolute truth, not that he doesn't see the individual objects, but he sees them, the individual objects, in relationship. Sorry for speaking in such a complex way, so late at night. But he sees everything in relationship to Krishna, and that is perfect vision. And to see anything as if it doesn't have a relationship with the absolute truth, that is called maya or illusion. Because by definition, everything must have a relationship with the absolute truth. By definition, if such an absolute truth is there. By definition, everything is included in the absolute truth. So then, we discussed that there are three different ways of perceiving that absolute truth. You can perceive it, that same absolute truth, in Sanskrit, Advaya Gyan. The one absolute truth is perceived in three different ways depending upon how you approach it. If you approach through Gyan, you perceive, or knowledge, trying to understand everything. The ultimate is you perceive that the absolute is everywhere. There's nothing, everything is ultimately absolute, is part of the absolute. If you approach through yoga, and the danger of that, of course, is that you can't stay in that realization. You know, you're a part, you're everything, everything is everything. Now what do? And there's no you to even do. And it gets lonely. That's what Prabhupada once told me. That the soul cannot stay in that consciousness because it has to, it's by nature active, it wants to do something. He said they get lonely and they have to come down to material activities. And then by yoga one perceives the Paramatma in the Supreme. And what's the difficulty when you take that path is that if you practice yoga and you get some success, you get some powers, mystic powers. You can become so small or so big. And listen to this one. You can create anything you want, or you can put out your hand and you can, it's called prapti, and you can grab, and just imagine how much trouble you could get in if you had mystic powers. Prabhupada said that he knew someone who had visited his teacher, who had a yogi for a teacher, a guru, and that person asked, the yogi asked his student, who Prabhupada personally knew, he said, "What would you like? Anything." And Prabhupada's friend said, "I want pomegranates from Afghanistan." Pomegranates, you know. So the yogi went like this, and he brought him that. And Prabhupada said they were out of season too. So Prabhupada had mentioned this after speaking to someone with who had that personal experience of being on the receiving end of that. So the problem with yoga is it's so easy to get enamored. What does enamored mean? How do you say that in Hebrew? Enchanted, something, bewildered by these little powers. You can read people's minds, you can control people's minds and things like that. It's so easy to start thinking, yes, I'm so wonderful, and then you start using it for yourself, and you become entangled in matter. And then there's bhakti yoga, which according to Kapila Muni, it causes you to perceive that same absolute truth in his personal feature. That's the topmost yoga and the topmost feature. And it's the topmost yoga because Kapila Muni explains that bhakti yoga dissolves the false ego, the false sense of self. Because you start in bhakti yoga with "I'm a servant of Krishna." So by bhakti, one sees the Supreme Person, and we spoke also about as sees the Supreme Person as the beloved, the object of one's love, and that fixes the consciousness completely. Love naturally fixes the consciousness on the beloved, and otherwise it's a struggle, and that's why we struggle with our japa, trying to bring the mind under control. But if there's love, there's no question of a struggle. It's just completely spontaneous and natural. So so what stops us from seeing the absolute truth? Instead we see things, everything is separate from the absolute truth. It's illusion, like a curtain. So what stops us is this curtain of illusion. So in the last presentation we discussed four different methodologies of helping the curtain be removed, that acting in such a way that Krishna will lift the curtain. Raise your hand if you remember one of them, and I'll ask you, okay? You raised your hand first, yes?
Hearing about Krishna,
thank you. A second one? Yes?
Trust in Krishna,
thank you. A third one? Yes?
Serving mood.
And then the fourth one was the first one? Yeah, chanting. Krishna's holy names, especially congregationally, where it's so much easier for the consciousness, the mind, the consciousness to become absorbed in the kirtan. So now, that's where we left off with the third presentation, and if the technology gods allow, we shall begin the fourth. Huh? The technology gods. Not as many.
What is his name?
And we don't want to chant those names. Well, why not?
You want to set it to mirror?
To what? I did that already. Yeah. I think I did. This one is called Del. And if you chant Del, you go to. That's why I didn't say it. Okay. Wow, no, that didn't work, but that did. You know who that is, by the way? No, good guess, but not correct. No. This, if you are in Govardhan town, there is one special temple that's sort of down, and that's called the Govardhan Lal Temple. And this is that Giriraj in there. He's actually so cute. Oh, he's gone. And I didn't do it. He disappeared. Okay, now, what do you do? Oh yeah, he's back. He's gone. Oh, we're back to the tangle of the mind again. Okay, now, but this is not an ordinary mind. This is a Vrindavan mind, a Vrindavan tree. Yes, let's see if this works. Well, we've gotten this far. We might need, is Vyas Prabhu here? I don't know if we're going to need some mystical harmonium incantations, but we shall see. There it is. Fluid reality, fixed absolute truth. And the first two presentations were on fluid reality, the third was on the fixed absolute truth, and the fourth is also on the fixed absolute truth. Now this one is going to go further and deeper into the path of bhakti. Can everyone see all right? Yes? Can you see all right? This presentation is entitled The Power of Bhava. The power of Bhava, the power of love for Krishna. This is a review, but this is, since we already spoke about it. Everyone perceives. Oh, could you read it?
Everyone perceives reality
slowly and
powerfully.
Yes, and with great feeling. Everyone perceives reality. No, not that's maybe a little extreme. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm not sure what would you like me to say. Everyone perceives reality according to his own mind, his own consciousness. This is actually Krishna's reciprocation with the individual soul. A devotee sees Krishna's mercy in whichever way his Lord reciprocates with him.
So that's the vision of reality that the devotee has. He sees Krishna everywhere. There's one verse, Savachahoya Nija Ishta Deva Sporti Stavaram Stagamam Deki Nadeki Taramuti, that the devotee, he doesn't actually exactly see the forms of everything, but Savachahoya Nija, he sees, Nija means his, Ishta Deva Sporti, he sees everything as an aspect or a form, a manifestation of his Lord, of his beloved Lord. So this vision is incredible, because and that if you have this vision, and it's not a matter of, there's a kind of glasses you can put on to get this vision, and those glasses are called, it's called prema, or love, of bhakti. Then you'll see Krishna everywhere. So a devotee, an actual devotee, sees Krishna's mercy in whichever way his Lord reciprocates with him. This is so, such amazing, wonderful consciousness, and it cannot be imitated. I mean, not that you're not allowed to imitate it. We are not allowed to imitate it, but even if we try to imitate it, we can't do it, and therefore we're not allowed. But this is exalted consciousness. And then tateyanu kampam susamitramano, everyone, bhunjane vatma kritam vapakam ridvag vapurbir vidatan namaste jivateyo muktipade sadayavak. So jivateyo muktipade sadayavak means if one, this consciousness is ideal. It can't be imitated, but we should keep the ideal upon our heads with reverence. That if we see, whatever happens, we see, this is my karma, and Krishna so kindly lightened it for me. And then when something happens unfortunate, or even something fortunate, one, within the core of his heart, with his words, and with his body, he offers his obeisances very humbly to the Lord. And such a person who is like that, jivatiyo, such a jiva who is like that, mukti pade sadayava, he as naturally as a son inherits the property of from his father, this such a person who has this consciousness inherits the kingdom of God. And how secure and peaceful such a person will be, because he's always, by his consciousness, in the presence of his beloved Lord. How wonderful. Here is a little literal translation. 14th chapter of the 10th canto. Who is speaking it, this verse? It's Lord Brahma. He says, my dear Lord, please.
My dear Lord,
just slowly, that's my only request.
One who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds, and offering you respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim.
So this is. This is such a way to advance, actually. And it's not that we should help others advance when something terrible happens to one of our devotee friends. We say, "Krishna's mercy, no problem." Not in that way, but ourselves, we should see Krishna's kindness in everything. There was one young girl that I knew who's now not a young girl. She used to go to school with my daughter in Vrindavan, and some of you know her. And when she's from New Zealand, and then when she went back from, her parents are French. When she went back to New Zealand, she was just a young teenage girl, and very quickly she had purple hair, and began flirting with the material energy. And then, I don't know how exactly it happened, but while she was 13 years old, or at most 14, she had a terrible accident, and she broke her back and became quadriplegic. That means she could not move. She can't move either of her arms or her legs, except in the most minimal way. So for a 14-year-old or a 13-year-old whose life is before them, and this happening to, how do you deal with it? Well, one thing is clear, if you have a superficial sentiment, oh yes, everything is Krishna's mercy, that sentiment will be knocked over immediately by the seeming unfairness of such a thing that occurred to you. And how much fair or unfair, what a life, I don't have a life. So, years after, and oh yeah, and you know her, and Efrat, you know her name is Chetuleka. And years and years later, I asked her a question that I was eager to hear the answer to. I didn't expect her to spout back some philosophy to me. But I asked her, well, how are you dealing with this? And I asked her, are you angry at Krishna? There you are as a devotee, and we all know that nothing bad ever happens to devotees when we're, there we are, we join to remove all our difficulties. But I asked her, do you get angry at Krishna? And she answered, still unable to move anything. She answered, no, I think Krishna saved me from acting in so many bad ways. That's what she actually said. It was Krishna's mercy. Also in China one time, when I went to, I may have mentioned this, I went to the one small city, not small city, there are no small cities in China, practically, but only had like 1 million people in it. Or more than that, named Wuxi, and it was almost all ladies. Most of them were very, very old, and the youngest of them was probably 45, and she had got cancer. I believe it was quite soon after she began chanting. So I asked the same kind of question to her. I said, well, how do you ask these kind of questions when you're there to be teaching them in some way? So I asked her, well, how do you feel about that? You became a devotee, and immediately you very quick after you got cancer. And by the way, it was 10 years in remission at this point. And she said, Krishna was very kind to me. I had so many material attachments. And then when I saw the other old lady, so I started asking them things, and I was thinking, now who's come to teach who here? Because this consciousness is exalted. So a devotee fixes as his goal, as his Krishna conscious goal, to change his bhava. Some definitions of bhava: ecstasy, state of being, mood, consciousness, nature, from a self-centered spirit of enjoyment. Bhava is, say, the mood, or you could say it's the lens by which we view all the rest of the world. If you don't think that your mood or consciousness affects what you see, then we have to start all over again at lesson one to make this point. But it's so clear. So clear to me. And a simple example is when if I have to get a new watch, everywhere I look I see watches. If I'm interested in I suddenly get interested in gardens and plants, I start seeing gardens and plants everywhere. If it's time for me to buy which hasn't happened this life, a new house, then I see for sale signs, at least in Australia, on so many houses. I don't know how they all got there all of a sudden. So it's so much our mood and our desire that affects what we see. So a devotee he wants to fix us as Krishna conscious goal. He wants to change his bhava from a self-centered spirit of enjoyment and looking at the world and other people as if their existence was for my pleasure. Want to change that self-centered illusory bhava, which pleases no one, not the person I'm looking at, nor myself, to a bhava that is pleasing to Krishna. That's what Krishna consciousness means. Lecture by Srila Prabhupada, March 14th, 1976, on Prayers of Prahlad, Mayapur. Oh, do we have the little plug in there?
Yeah, got it.
Yes, we do.
I am the Sangha. I belong to this family. I belong to this nation. How is ecstasy? What everyone is, for one man, to such kind of ecstasy. The politicians, they think that we are simply wasting time in chanting and dancing. They have no sense how to improve the position of the country. They do not like, because they are in different vow. And we are trying to change that vow. The bhava must be there. The whole Krishna consciousness movement is to purify the bhava. That is stated here. Parishuddha bhava. We are not negativating everything. We are simply changing from material bhava to spiritual bhava. Here is a big building. There are many others, hundreds and thousands of big buildings in this district or in this country. But here, the bhava is changed. Bhava is changed. In your country, there are many big skyscraper buildings. In comparison to those buildings, this is nothing. But still, you have come spending thousands of dollars here to change the bhava. That is it. That is required. Otherwise, the American boys and girls, you have no business to come here to see this big building, no. To change the bhava. That is very important. So, sarvabhadi vinimuttam tat parastena nimmalam rishikena rishikesam sevanam bhakti chati rishikesa sevanam. That bhava is bhakti means to change the bhava. At the present moment, we are in a different bhava. It has to be cleansed, parishuddha bhava, prakrishta rupena, pari, suddha, clarified, cleansed bhava. We have nothing to reject. Simply, we have to change the bhava.
So this is our mission. To change our bhava, to change our mood to one of very deep Krishna consciousness. The Lord's heart is affected by bhakti and nothing else, from the commentary of Srila Jiva Goswami on this Bhagavad, on a Bhagavatam verse. Chapter 41 is when Krishna has just entered Mathura. The heart, the Lord's heart, is affected by bhakti and nothing else. So this is what we want to do. We want to change our bhava to bhakti, our mood to bhakti, because that affects Krishna. One's bhava is so important. Even Krishna himself will be differently perceived according to one's bhava. So this is even on the spiritual level. This is from this the 43rd chapter, I believe, of the 10th canto, when Krishna enters the wrestling arena. The various groups of people in the arena regarded Krishna in different ways when he entered it with his elder brother. The wrestlers saw Krishna as a lightning bolt. The men of Mathura saw him as the best of males. The women saw him as Cupid in person. The cowherd men saw him as their relative. The impious rulers saw Krishna as a chastiser. His parents saw him as their child. The king of Bhojas, Kamsa, saw Krishna as death. The unintelligent saw Krishna as the Supreme Lord's universal form. So this is one Krishna, and according to one's own mood, even if face to face with Krishna, one will see him differently. And the yogi saw Krishna as the absolute truth, and the Vrishnis, the member of Krishna's family, saw him as their supreme worshipable deity. So bhava is everything, in a sense. The power of bhava, which was the title of this whole presentation. An example, the queens of Dwarka, how powerful bhava is from the first canto of the Bhagavatam when Krishna enters Dwarka. Let me just go back to here. Oops. It's not going back. Okay. So, when Krishna entered Dwarka, he had been away for many months due to the battle of Kurukshetra. And when he was just a little distance outside of the city, he blew his conch shell. And the citizens who had been, because the nature of their love for Krishna was that they were continuously thinking of him and thinking that today is the day that Krishna will return. Today is the day. It will be today. And then on this day, they heard the sound of Krishna's conch shell. Krishna blew it from outside of the city. And they heard that transcendental sound. And they recognized it immediately as Krishna's conch shell. That was their mood. And then most of the citizens immediately ran outside of the city, or ran to the gates to meet Krishna, and then Krishna entered. And everyone was there, practically speaking, to greet Krishna. Not because you're supposed to greet Krishna when he comes home after being away for so long, but because of their natural, spontaneous love for Krishna. And Krishna reciprocated with everyone. The city was immediately decorated to make it pleasing for him to see. And Krishna glanced at everyone, and people came and made offerings to him. Everyone was there because everyone loved Krishna. And then Krishna, well, he went first to the house of his father, Vasudev, and he offered respects to his father and all of to Devaki and all of Vasudev's other queens. And then he walked into his palaces. And there, after so long being separated from Krishna, the queens saw him. And they were very shy. Naturally, they wanted to rush forward and embrace him. But they didn't. They were kept back by their shyness. And then what they did was they sent forward their sons to embrace Krishna. And in that way, they're experiencing the embrace of Krishna to the sons, his sons, their sons, as if they were embracing Krishna themselves. But in their hearts, they were embracing Krishna very tightly. So, in one verse, to show the power of bhava, here is one verse at the end of this chapter, and then we'll hear something from Prabhupada's purport. Although the queen's beautiful smiles and furtive glances were all spotless and exciting, and although they could conquer Cupid himself by making him give up his bow in frustration, and although even the tolerant Shiva could fall victim to them, the queens, and their beauty and their charm, still, despite all their magical feats and attractions, they could not agitate the senses of the Lord, because he's fully complete. But yet there was Krishna coming into the houses, and he would joke with them, into the palaces, he would joke with them, he would treat them just like as if he was, in Prabhupada's words, like a henpecked husband. He would do what they say and everything. And now, how is this? He wasn't trying to get something from them. His senses weren't disturbed, but yet he was acting as the most dear husband. So here is from Srila Prabhupada's purport, we've taken out a part. The queens could not satisfy the Lord by their feminine attractiveness, but they satisfied him by their sincere affection and service. Only by unalloyed transcendental loving service could they satisfy the Lord. Only by pure bhakti, their deep bhakti to him, their love for him, they satisfied him completely. And the Lord, due to their love for him, was pleased to treat them as wives in reciprocation. They wanted to love him as my dear, dear husband, and in reciprocation, he acted to them as the most perfect of husbands. Thus, being satisfied by their unalloyed service only, the Lord reciprocated the service just like a devoted husband. So this is the way that the unconquerable Lord, this is the power of bhava, this is the power of prema, of love for Krishna, this is the power of bhakti, that it completely, ultimately, this loving mood, which is transcendental, it's not of the material world, it's of the spiritual world, it is so powerful that it controls the all-powerful. This is described in the 31st chapter of the 10th canto. This is what's described, Naparyaham, that Krishna remains indebted to his devotees. This is the Lord. He's not like a dictator pushing the enter button. You know, the only way you can be happy is if you love and serve me. Do you understand that? Well, if you don't, you have to go to the material world and understand it. And there you will learn to love me. Okay, do you understand it? And you're not going to be happy unless you love me. He's not like that. He's not like a dictator. You know, he has some self-esteem problem that he creates all these souls that can't be happy unless they love him. No, it's just the opposite. His nature, he's composed of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. This is what his existence is. And yet, when the devotee loves him, he reciprocates with that love. He's not on his throne, a faceless old man. Because that's how he's often portrayed. You know, just a faceless old man on a throne. I don't think it's not so much in Judaism, though, right? They don't get that far. They don't, but they think he's an old man, though, right? I mean, subtly. And how old is he? He has a long beard? Does he have a long beard? How long is it? If he's eternal, how long is his beard? Just consider that. But he's not like that. If he can stop the usual conception that people have in their mind, he's like 80 or something like that. But he's eternal. So if he could stop aging at 80, I mean, if you could stop aging at 80 and you had the power to stop aging, where would you rather stop? At 16, like Krishna stops? Or 80? He's eternally 16 years old. Imagine being, there's an old Chinese curse, may you live to 1,000. Imagine, may you live eternally like that in a material body. So Krishna is not a dictator like that, but rather he prefers to be known as Bhaktivatsalya Krishna. He's the beloved of his devotees and the lover of his devotees. He is in the heart of his devotees and the devotees are in his heart. An infinite regression, as they say. So this is Krishna. He's completely controlled by the love of the queens of Dwarka. Their love for him is so complete and powerful that they control him. But this is all on the transcendental platform. This is in Dwarka. So as we mentioned, that the natural and spontaneous bhava of the Vrijavasis is so powerful that it places Krishna, the all-powerful Supreme Personality of Godhead, under their control. My dear Uddhav, the unalloyed devotional service Bhaktir Mamorjita, rendered to me by my devotees, brings me under their control, Krishna says this. So, and we're afraid of, you know, if we learn to love Krishna, we're afraid that, first of all, we can think of what it is that we're afraid of. What are we afraid of losing? We're afraid of being out of control. In my control anymore or something like that. But just see what devotional service actually is and what Krishna consciousness is actually presenting. And the rest of the verse. I cannot be thus controlled, the sadhyati, by those engaged in mystic yoga, Sankhya philosophy, pious work, Vedic study, austerity or renunciation. Nothing controls Krishna like bhakti. But the devotee, obviously he's not doing things so he can control, I want to control Krishna, except on a very high level. That may be true. But he's not like, he's just fallen in love with Krishna on the deepest spiritual level. That's the end of our presentation. So somehow or another, we went from quantum physics to Vrindavan. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Why don't we turn on the lights? So. Yes.
Sounds like something that can change
his behavior. What? Say again?
Mood.
Bhava. Well, bhava, yeah. But that's one meaning of bhava. Yes. So how do we change our bhava, actually?
No. The spiritual bhava, is it something more fixed? Or is it like a mood that they just...
Well, actually, bhava bhakti, this very high state which is before love of Krishna, it is what it actually is when the soul, because we're tiny, we always need a shelter. So the shelter that every conditioned soul takes, the shelter that every soul who has a false ego takes, is the material energy, Krishna's Maya Shakti, Ma Maya Shakti. So here we are in Krishna's Maya Shakti, like an emerged, submerged in an ocean of illusion. And we hear the holy books, we chant Krishna's names, we associate with devotees, we worship the deities, we perform so many different, we read, we study, we hear, we perform service, we do so many aspects of bhakti. And gradually, gradually, the lower parts of our consciousness are removed, or maybe quickly, and what starts arising within us is the desire to actually have a relationship with Krishna. We give up that desire to be independent, and we desire to love Krishna, to serve Krishna. We examine through experience our life, our own life and the lives of others, and we conclude on one level with our intelligence, this is my path, and another level we become attracted to Krishna. He's attractive, he's all attractive from what we hear about him. And the kirtan has potency, worshipping the deities have potency, serving Krishna, talking to others about Krishna has potency. So in this way our faith is increasing, our desire is increasing, and our moods increase sometimes, and they flicker this way and flicker that way. So that's bhava, meaning the mood of someone in the material world. And then after some time we get more purified in our taste or our desire gets somewhat fixed, and we don't waver so much. Like today I want to be a devotee, and tomorrow I want to be a Formula One driver of fast cars. It doesn't fluctuate like that, and we become fixed. This is actually what I want. And then from that comes a taste. Krishna allows a taste to enter the conditioned soul's heart. And then that is called the stage of ruchi. And then when that taste progresses further, naturally we get attached to everything that gives us pleasure, whether it's strawberry ice cream or Krishna. Whatever gives us pleasure, we become attached to it. So we become more and more attached to Krishna, and attraction for him grows and grows and grows. And then at that stage we're still conditioned souls under the material energy, taking shelter of Maya. But we don't want it anymore. We don't want it at all. And we can't live without Krishna's names. We can't live without serving Krishna. We want to serve him in a specific, not even general way, and we know that. We know who we are in relationship with Krishna. But yet here we are under the shelter of the material energy. But the desire to be with Krishna, to serve Krishna, is overflowing, and it's and here I am, I can't do it. But just imagine what the chanting of such a person is like. You know, it's such a calling out to Krishna. If you're not merciful to me, Krishna, what can I do? Oh, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Oh, Krishna, the taste of such a person. Just everywhere he's looking, everything he sees, where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? Krishna, help me, allow me to serve you, Krishna, Krishna. His whole life is completely aflame with that desire, and yet he's still in the shelter of the material energy of the Maya Shakti. And then, when Krishna desires, or when Krishna's exalted devotee desires, then Krishna says, okay, you want this so much. And then that's called bhava bhakti. And what that bhava bhakti is, that the soul gets the shelter of the internal energy. His shelter switches from the Maya Shakti, which is a reflection, or a reflection of the spiritual energy, which is the internal energy, Antaranga Shakti, Sandini Sambit. And then when that enters the heart, then one one is actually oneself. Now we're in the process of self-realization, discovering oneself, because our self, who we are, is incomplete without having the shelter of Krishna's internal energy, which means the shelter of Krishna, which means the shelter of Krishna's service. So that's his energy of service. So at that point, we're actually devotees. Or, as Nectar Devotion Bhakti Samhita Sindhu describes, then our sadhana practice actually begins. The sadhana from bhava to prema. So, that's actually the power of bhava, the power of... And we want to change to that, and we can't do it but from our own, by our own power, but by our own power we can try to understand, we try to hear, we try to chant, we try to listen, we try to change our desires from being self-centered, selfish, materialistic desires to, instead of only if I could have a new computer, to only, and then I'd be happy, or if I had a better job, or a better this, or better that, to only if I could love Krishna, and I don't want anything else. So that's what we gradually want, that's the path of our gradual progression, it's based on desire. Is that clear? Clear? So we can ask ourselves, well, what do I want? Sometimes, but at least when we're talking to ourselves, we should be honest. See how unfortunate as I am. Yes, I desire to be a devotee, but I also desire this, and I desire that, and I desire that. And my desire to be a devotee, it burns hot, not burns hot and cold, but it's hot sometimes and it's cold sometimes, and it's in between, and from one minute it could be this, the next minute that. So what to do? That's what a conditioned soul is like. So we live a Krishna conscious lifestyle, which is basically essentially a good lifestyle, one that cultivates goodness. And that steadies the consciousness a lot. And then gradually we hear about Krishna and try to chant better, etc., etc. The whole process is the process of moving forward. Any other questions or comments? And when we try to move steadily, whatever spark is there, we try to fan. Any other questions?
What's the difference between above and below?
What's the difference between a sprout and a full-blown tree? So bhava is called prem ankur. Ankur means the sprout of prem. So it has to mature into a full-grown tree of prem, and then that tree gives fruits, and the fruits of that tree are prema. So there are the exact characteristics are described in Nectar Devotion Bhakti Samhita Sindhu. The characteristics of Bhava Bhakti are described as two. Madhurya Kadambini by Srila Vishwanatha Chakrabarti Thakur describes the characteristics of each stage. But we're meant to move along on the path. Yeah, that's the essence. You want, what do you, if you really want to see Krishna, there's this one song that that I don't have it on my computer, it's so interesting, that George Harrison made with Ravi Shankar, in two different versions, sort of an Indian version and a more Western version, called I'm Missing You, Krishna. Do you hear that? It's so, on one level, it's just so cute, cutesy, and it's so, it sounds like a teeny papa song or something. Mm-hmm. But Prabhupada really liked it. He said, oh, I think he was trying to encourage George Harrison too, but he said, this is in the mood of separation of Sanatan Goswami. But it's really, really simple. It only has two or three lines. It's, I'm missing you, Krishna. Where are you? Well, it's Krishna consciousness, really. What's the rest of it? Good. Yeah. Well, that's like, yeah, thank you. That's our whole philosophy, you know, very high part of it. We're missing you, Krishna. Now we're not with Krishna, but we don't miss him at all. What to speak of crying for him? You know, what causes us to cry? It's when, you know, when something happens to us, favorable or unfavorable. But when Krishna is the central part of it, could you say that again? I'm missing you, Krishna.
Where are you?
We don't ask where are you, Krishna? This is Kunti Devi prays like this to Maya Jivani Karchanam, that the curtain of Maya covers you, and although you are everywhere, I cannot see you anywhere. And I don't even care. But so then we should feel a little unfortunate. And then, but I'm missing you, Krishna. Where are you?
So I can't see you. I hear your flute all the while.
All the while. I hear your flute continuously. I hear one. If we take that a little metaphorically, we could say, I see you, the traces of you, the hints that you're there, all the time, all the while. You know, you come to me when I'm trying to serve you and I'm not doing very well. You know, you reveal that you're there, watching me, with me. But where are you? And then.
Please come wipe my tears and make.
Please come. I'm crying for you. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. This was the mood that Mahaprabhu taught, actually. To be missing Krishna. Not to be finding him, even, but to be missing Krishna. Do you like that song? Do you have it? Do you have it with you? Did you hear? You have both versions of it? Me too. Which one do you like? Yeah. Just even talking about a more elevated state of Krishna consciousness, knowing that I'm nowhere near that state, is so satisfying to the heart in its own way. What to speak of that experience, the ecstasy that comes from that. The questions, comments? Yes.
Is missing association of devotees as good as missing Krishna?
Well, yes and no. the yes is, or I'll start with the no, it makes it easier. If the no is, if the no, if you miss them on the level of I need someone to go shopping with, and I need, you know, if it's on a mundane level, then the mundane component, of course, with a devotee, here we go. Generally, I prefer cowering tones, mooing, but this one seems to really work. So if our consciousness is seeing them, really seeing them as devotees, and I miss them from the point of view of the devotees in so many ways, you know, that I learn from them, you know, there's a sweetness in their association. If it's only that, yes. And then, if it's more for just to, for because we're social beings, then it's not exactly the same. But still important. And Prabhupada once, he told me that we have to make friendship with the devotees. And if we don't make friendship with devotees, because we're social by nature, we will make friendship with non-devotees. And if we make friendship with non-devotees, I'll even tell you the incident, it's even more dramatic. It was in the Hong Kong Hilton. And we were waiting for the elevator. And I was standing next to Prabhupada, and he was saying this, that we are social by nature, we have to make friendship with the devotees. If we don't make friendship with the devotees, because we are social, the elevator door opens on the floor. And he says, then, if we don't make association with the devotees, because we're social by nature, we will be forced to make friendship with materialistic people, and then we will not be able to follow the principles. And Prabhupada gets in, and the doors are about to close. It was so dramatic. It's true. Any other questions? So we need to. So you know, there, if we have social parts of our nature, so we should have a devotee, Krishna, as much as we practically can. It should be Krishna conscious and spiritual, and not talking about the other devotees all the time. Did you hear that? This it should be about the deeper the spiritual content, the better. But we're social by nature. So we need to have that fulfilled in the association of devotees. But yet it won't be the same as Krishna, unless we're that deep in our relationships, similarly deep devotees. Any other? Yes?
Can you expand on how Krishna is a reflection of the self?
I don't remember saying that. Krishna's.
How is Krishna a reflection of the self?
He's not a reflection of the self. But if we examine. But I don't remember saying that personally.
I said that.
Okay, you said that. Okay. But if we look in ourself, we'll be able to see aspects of Krishna. Like, we are. If we actually are able to perceive the self, we'll perceive our eternality. Krishna is also eternal. We'll be able to perceive, things like that. But if we just examine the self, we won't be able to see Krishna. If we examine Krishna and understand the philosophy of who Krishna is, then we'll also understand ourself. Or another way to look at it is that, as it says in the Bible, that man is made in. So that means that God looks something like us. I guess he was the generic man referring to ladies also. But But Krishna looks something like, if we look like him, he looks like us. So we, by examining, if we find out what we actually look like, or even now, if we have two arms and two legs, Krishna has two arms and two legs. If we have one head, we do, don't we? But then again, we have four heads, yeah? Everyone has four heads, and we have four arms. It's getting late, okay. Yeah, so Krishna looks something like that. So in that sense, by examining ourselves with some knowledge, we can understand something in a general way about who Krishna is and what he's like. In that sense. Any other questions or comments? Because it must be 8 o'clock. Well, it's 2 minutes to 8 according to my watch. Yes?
One question.
Yes.
All the time I've been hearing that it's very important to chant. Everything is chant, but is there anything that is like second in the hierarchy to chanting?
Well, there are five very potent items of devotional service. Chanting is one of them. Nama Sankirtan mentioned first. But second, we would say, and you could even say it's more important, is association with devotees. Because chanting is best done in the association of devotees. Then, also studying Srimad Bhagavatam, deeply trying to understand the Bhagavatam. Do you have a set of Bhagavatams in your house? Huh? Do we? We do. By the fact that that they're there and you thought they may be there would indicate that you're not generally a regular student of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the third one is studying Srimad Bhagavatam, trying to understand the importance of this, of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. The fourth one is worshipping the deities, and the fifth one is living in a holy place, or making one's home into a holy place. So those first three, we'll say, studying Srimad Bhagavatam, associating with devotees, and chanting Krishna's names. And then we also say that it all begins with Shravanam, by hearing from devotees. So that two are in that one. So saying with devotees, and then Satam Prasangam Mam Yavirayasam Ido. So that in the association of devotees we hear about Krishna. So these are very important and potent items of devotional service. Did you hear that? Whose ringtone? Okay, good night. Hare Krishna, thank you. So tomorrow night, I have some audio visual stuff, not stuff, things to show, but it'll be lighter, less philosophical. So tomorrow night we'll see everyone again. Krishna willing. Hare Krishna. I might even ask, what do you remember from tonight? So you can even think in advance. That's some of the things we spoke about, it, and if there's anything that was significant for you individually. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sisi Gaura Tai ki jai.